is Plantaholics, a plant podcast where Taylor and I, my co-host,
I'm Taylor,
and I is Tori. We talk about plants and everything related to plants. And
everything.
Literally, we've covered multiple topics. If you haven't heard them, and if you have a lot of extra time, check out season one.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. This is season
two. Or just season two.
Or just season two. If you want a more clean, precise episode, we're starting season two off. Or not start. This is... we're continuing season
episode
two.
Episode three.
Episode three with a much more succinct...
Yes.
...series. So, today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics of all time, which is forensic botany. Yes. Yes. So.
All right. So as we start off every episode.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far.
for season two.
Let's go through a planner action for this week. What are you bringing to the table here, Tori?
I'm kind of borrowing from last episode because I forgot the name of the amazing fruit that I tried at Costco, and I went back and it is a plum caught, and I am assuming it's plum plus apricot. That's my best guess.
I would hope so.
Yeah. Unless I'm missing something even more obvious, that's where that's what I'm betting everything on plum caught right now.
I think that's pretty safe.
Mm-hmm. Plum apricot. So so that was. I have not been outside much. It's been very hot and smoky here in Spokane, so I've been staying cooped up in my little cave of wonders. And it did rain, which was nice, and I got to see my rain chain get wet into my garden. So that's as planty as I experienced, unfortunately. Hey.
It was outdoors.
Yep. I saw it through my window. I didn't even go outside.
It still happened.
Mm-hmm. So what was your plant interaction this week?
Yeah. Mine actually happened today.
Ooh.
I went on a site visit for work, and it was one of my previous clients who called me back for just a couple things. And he was kind of like warning me in advance, like, all right, like, the backyard, my wife is calling it a jungle. and I went in back, and he has like, okay, this is a new home in California. So like this backyard is like 12 feet deep by, you know, whatever, 40 feet. He's got like at least 16 different types of fruit trees in various pots.
Oh my
and like,
God.
It's so amazing. And we were just like nerding out over it together.
Oh my God.
He's like, yeah, I have to do something. And like, anyway, so he has all these fruit trees. And then, anyway, he was talking about raising some planters and stuff. And he has these snail vines. And and I was like, oh, well, you know, if we're going to raise this planter, you know, the soil level is going to be higher. You probably, you know, we either need to transplant this or get rid of it. He's like, I have to keep it because my tortoise loves the flowers. And he's like they're like dessert for him.
Oh,
he loves them. So then he goes and shows me the tortoise, and he's like, here, look. And he just starts feeding him the purple snail vine flowers. And yes, he was very excited.
Gosh. Did he do a little turtle dance, like where he shakes his little shell?
Yep, he was adorable.
So cute.
Anyway, so I had a fun morning just looking into this jungle. There's literally like we installed a bunch of papers back there. It is just all pots. Like it is just, it's like he spared no space for like,
oh my
it's
God.
Great.
It's like, so how do you walk? Is like why would I
some
walk?
Some of them are on wheels.
Yeah. Okay. I can always move them around.
Yeah.
That's my kind of backyard. That's awesome.
Oh yeah. No, I was like, this is great. He's like, my wife does not agree. I'm like, well, it is great.
You should marry the tortoise.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, a lot of my decisions are based on this tortoise. I'm like, that's okay.
I actually completely understand.
Yeah. I get it. Anyway, that was
man. Now I really want a tortoise.
I know. It was really cute. It's like, yeah, it hibernates half the year. Like, it's a pretty easy pet. I'm like, yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. I could knit little sweaters for its shell.
Aww.
That'd be cute.
He has a little label. He has kind of like, he calls it a license plate that he has on the back of it, like, in case he escapes.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny. Please return tortoise to this address.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yep.
Makes sense, though. I had a neighbor who had a tortoise and it escaped.
Yeah.
It's there. I think they had a few
tortoises.
You
wouldn't think they get far, but they do.
They when they want to go, they're gone.
Yeah, yeah.
they didn't have snail vines, so he had no incentive to stay.
No reason.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay, that was awesome. Learned a little bit about tortoises and how to please them.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about forensic botany today.
Yes, we are. Yeah,
I do not know a lot about this at all, so. Let's do this.
I know a good amount only because I am a true crime fan. If you haven't noticed from previous episodes, especially starring one of our friends, she and I both love true crime. So this is a really cool topic, mostly because I think it's underused in a lot of crime solving. And it's something that is in almost every crime. Mm-hmm. And so kind of some few fun facts about, I was surprised, there's not a lot of fun facts about forensic botany. I looked
just horrifying
everywhere. Or more, it's just like, it just tells you what it is, and it's like, and then it just goes into the information about it. I'm like, but
that's a good way to start.
What are some fun tidbits? Like, there's no, like, this happened. Like, you know, every topic tends to have, like, fun facts, like, top 10.
Yeah, yeah.
I had none of that in this topic, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
So,
got to make our own here.
Yeah. So I'm going to put quotations and or bunny ears around the word fun for this. And so the use of forensic botany in our U.S. legal system has only been around for 75 years. Obviously, biology has been around much longer, and all of the things that I'm going to talk about have been around longer, but it really kind of started as a forensic science 75 years ago, and I'll touch base on what case that was. So that's number one. Number two, it's kind of just like I feel like it's common sense, but pollen and spores are actually really hard for criminals to eliminate because they're so small and microscopic. And I did not know this, but they're resilient to dehydration and degradation. And obviously, because they're so small, they're really easy to transfer from surfaces like shoes and clothes, which is why they're really great uses for evidence, because if you can't see it, but it's something that's transferred, it's going to be there. And you can't try to get rid of it like with fingerprints. You can wear gloves, or you can wipe something down, or blood spatter and such. I'm going to do a quick, not TMI, what is it? Trigger warning, maybe?
Okay.
I might touch on some graphic things that might be displeasing for people. So if you're not, it's not going to be a lot because it's going to be mostly plant focused, but I will talk about dead bodies and decomposition and such. So if that bothers you, probably just say goodbye and see us next in a few weeks and do another topic. Or check out season one. It's up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not the mummy.
Yeah. So. I was like, maybe avoid the mummification and love potions. Avoid all of my topics.
As a general rule.
Yeah. If Tori is doing a topic, plug your ear.
God.
But if we dissect the word forensic botany, forensics is the application of scientific techniques used to investigate a crime. And when you add botany, it uses plant parts and plants to within the investigation of criminal cases, legal disputes, and as well as ascertaining death and death locations, except crime scenes.
Gotcha.
So we put them together, and that's kind of what it means. So branches, there's actually branches of forensic botany, which I did not know about. So that was kind of cool. So these branches are kind of come together and create forensic botany. And you don't really just use one in a criminal case, mm-hmm. but some of these are a little bit more general, while as others are more specific, going into the plant parts that they focus on, while as others are kind of just like you, it's just kind of like ecosystem, yeah. As I'll show you, I'll tell you, like just the way a plant looks. So
sure.
The first branch would be forensic plant morphology. So this is kind of the external features of a plant, identifying the species of the plant. And this can be used in a case to like know what the plant is, what species, where it's from. So it's kind of basic. You'll pretty much use this in almost every aspect of a case as a forensic botanist, because you're going to have to know what it looks like. Obviously, some forensic botanists will look at something that is not visible or you can't actually see the structure. For example, mm-hmm. if it's in someone's stomach or if it's been digested in feces, that's the stuff that this isn't really relevant. But if you're looking at a few cases I'll bring up, they're actually looking at seed pods. It's like, okay, well, what seed pod is this from? This is a blank seed pod. So that's kind of where this comes in, is understanding how to pretty much identify plants.
Is that like when they're, I just cannot think of a situation in which they would need to identify a seed pod. Like, is it found? Like,
actually, I will talk about that. A seed pod was really huge part of a case.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got my interest.
Okay. I got you with the seed pod.
I'm just like, when on earth do you need to use this?
You would be surprised.
I know I will be, because okay. I cannot think of a situation. It's like, it's okay. A legume, everyone.
It's a legume. Well,
I solved it.
I'll tell you, I will get into it. A seed pod was a huge breakthrough in one of the cases that I will talk about.
All right.
So another branch, which is very similar to plant morphology, is forensic plant anatomy. So this is mm-hmm. more of the internal structure of the plants, identifying its classification and the cells of the plants. So this kind of tells you a little bit more information about the plant that you see. So they kind of go hand in hand, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The next one, I think, is probably one of the most important, or at least the most common I've seen used in forensic botany, is forensic palynology, which is the study of pollen, grains, and spores, as well as like microscopic plant bodies. So this mm-hmm. helps. So this mm-hmm. is used because a lot of the times we're always inhaling pollen in our nostrils. Mm-hmm. And so when you exhume a body, or if you find a body, or even like a, it's like all over, like spores, you'll just see it on, we just carry them around all the time without seeing them because they're so small.
Right.
And this helps prove or disprove mostly like a link between people, objects, and places. So it's really common to connect a person to a crime scene, because if you examine the nostrils, you'll be able to get a plant or a pollen profile of a bunch of different plants. And then you can, sure. I remember I watch crime shows all the time, and I remember this one show, I forgot, but it was in England, and they were able to narrow down a very small zone of area within all of the UK that this body could have died in and was transferred. Mm-hmm. And, or like, I can't remember if it was a body or if it was a shoe or something. I think it was a shoe, but they were able to say that this person was in this area recently. And that actually connected to the deceased human. And they were like, he's got to have been there at some point. And so that's kind of where the pollen profile comes in, especially when you get a bunch together. It's like, there's a lot of overlapping circles, and then you're gonna like, okay, it's gotta be this one area. It's very
I think that's what I assumed forensic botany was. Like, that's the one thing I would like think of, or besides like they swallowed a poisonous plant. Like, you know.
Yeah. It's definitely the most common, like I've looked up common cases, and it seems to be the one that's the most widely used and the one that's probably the most helpful. They're also using it to see if a body has been moved. So it helps you identify if it's been in multiple locations and when.
Right.
Um, it's also helped identify like grave sites and how old they are and when, like, for example, some grave sites have been moved, like old historical sites, and they're like, it was moved this time, and they can use pollen for that, which I think is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And then another thing about pollen is it's so easy to transfer. So it's something that you can't see. And like I mentioned before, and the fun fact is that it's like really resilient and lasts a really long time because it doesn't degrade. So it'll last years and years and years. So that's why these historical sites don't really have a lot of information besides the pollen and the nasal cavity and such.
Right.
Another popular one is forensic dendronagrology. Dendrochronology. Why can I not speak?
Trees?
Dendrochronology. Yeah, it's trees, but it's the study of estimating growth of tree rings. So it's kind of like
dendrochronology.
Thank you.
Okay.
I cannot just say big sciencey words, which is why you're
here. That's an interesting one.
Yeah. So this one was actually, it's fascinating because this was the first use of forensic botany was this type of branch. And this was the first time it was ever used in the U.S.
Branch.
Way to bring it around. No, it didn't sound. Never mind. Ring around. Okay.
Yes.
So this is the study that can estimate the exact year or formation of a growth of a tree ring and can actually determine the period where the criminal activity, when the criminal activity occurred. So that's kind of helpful. It also kind of helps allow you to tell the time of the skeletonization of a corpse as well. So it's also interesting because it's used to determine the use of illegal logging as well. So they've banned the logging of certain trees, and so they'll be able to, looking at the rings, you can tell if it's an illegal tree or not. So that's why it's used in a lot of, not just murders, but it's very common in rape cases. It's very common in, I mean, it's used in like almost every kind of, even like legal disputes, it's used as well. Yeah. This next one is really cool, is forensic limnology, which is the studying the presence of types of diatoms. So this is kind of more microscopic algae. So this is very relevant if things are found in freshwater. It's only freshwater because the water that we drink gets rid of all the diatoms. But this is mainly used to identify like cause, time, and place of death in the cases of drowning. So whether it also helps determine whether the death occurred due to drowning or if the person was placed in the water after death. So this is kind of where it comes in.
How does that differentiate?
So what happens is, for example, if it was asphyxiation resulting in the of inhaling water through the respiratory tract, it'll go through the pulmonary. I'm sorry, this is all kind of hard to do. It's like alveoli. Alveoli, I cannot say words.
Oh, alveoli?
Yes.
Okay.
And so,
yeah.
By going through that, it would show a presence of diatoms in the internal organs, like the bone marrow and the brain. But if it was placed in after death, the presence of the diatoms would only be seen in the respiratory tract and not the internal. So that's
the
difference. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
It's like if they're alive, it kind of goes through the whole process of transferring it to the organs. But if you're dead, you're not. That process is done.
Right. Tricky.
People are pretty smart.
Yep.
This next one is kind of, I'm not really sure how this relates besides like kind of with the first two. It's just kind of basic plant knowledge, which is forensic plant systematics. I could say that one. And that's just the process of classification of plants into different classes and families based on their morphological and genetic characteristics. So I'm assuming it's just part of the like elimination and categorization process of like, oh, what plant is this? How does this relate? Okay. The last one, which I think is actually really, I think I would say is probably the top three uses today, is forensic ecology. So this is the relationship between different plant and animal species within an ecosystem. So it mostly helps to identify concealed or buried corpses or bodies. And this can be revealed by showing structural changes in the vegetation in the area for a long time. And mushrooms. Yep, mushrooms is an example. Or I think I was reading one article and she was saying that a forensic botanist was saying, like, a body will actually provide shade. And so that will prevent certain plants from growing. But but some plants will react better to it. So some plants will, there's also like the release of nitrogen and such. I'll touch on some a little bit more later about how that kind of is related. Okay. But yeah. That's kind of, it's mostly, that kind of science is mostly used to identify and even with the searching for bodies, because there's a lot of groups out there that actually are part of the search and rescue or like looking for people who are missing. And this is part of like, it's good to be, they have like teams. I looked this up. I forgot what the group was called. I cannot find it again, but it's like a group of people who have crime investigative or criminal backgrounds or scientific backgrounds. I wanted to be part of it, but I don't have any of the necessary requirements. But some of the scientists that are part of the team are biologists, and they look for this forensic ecology signs where they are able to identify like plant growth and how it changes if it was disturbed, if the ground is disturbed, and how the plants react to the ground disturbing. And it kind of help find missing people or people who have passed.
Yeah. No.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah, so some examples, I think I touched on a little bit, but kind of using all of those branches and coming together and kind of focusing more on the different parts of the plant that we can use. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, pollen is very small, and it could help characterize a specific region where a crime has been committed. And an example, kind of what I talked about, would be looking at the nasal passages of a victim or the clothing of a suspect. And mm-hmm. it can determine where a person died or where they came from. So especially if you're trying to identify a missing person and you don't know who they are, they could help with it as well. And I know they've done some things with genetics now, which is really interesting, is they'll be able to tell, like looking at people's hair, like the water they were drinking, where they're like looking at people's teeth. Oh. And it's just amazing what they can do.
Jeez.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's amazing. Science is pretty dang cool.
Yep. Sounds expensive.
Yeah, it's really, it's expensive. I think the biggest thing is just it's so time consuming. I mean, it's very expensive, but I think it's also very time consuming.
Mm-hmm. Which is also expensive.
Exactly. That's part of the problem. But there's a lot of nonprofits out there who will kind of, and like I know a lot of the podcasts that I actually listen to offer to do like DNA tests to cover the cost. So it's so it's really, I think cost nowadays is not as big a deal as just getting someone to do it and taking the time to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So an example of using wood would be, this is what I was talking about before. The very first time it was used in the U.S. was actually for dendrology or dendrochronology. Yeah. So they use wood variety or wood grain and knots that act actually like a fingerprint. And it was the wood of a ladder that led to the conviction of Bruno Richard Haputin. And this was in 1935 because he was accused of kidnapping the Lindbergh babies, like one of the most popular crimes out, or not popular, but like well-known crimes.
Yeah.
So this was that crime was the first use of forensic botany in the legal system in the U.S.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it was not the ladder. I don't.
So it was the, so they, he looked at the ladder's wood material and was able to figure out what tree it came from and and the plant material. And they looked at this guy's suspect, and he had the exact tree, like they matched the tree fingerprint to fingerprint.
Oh, okay.
Because it was so they were like, this is the tree it came from. He has this wood in his shop. This is the guy. Like that's how they were able to convict him, because it was pretty much that. And it was interesting. I'll talk about it when I talk about some cases. And But it was interesting because people, this was the first time people were hearing about it, and they were calling it like junk science. And they were using other sciences to say, well, this is the sciences that are, that we're using that are good. And that nowadays those are all junk science now.
Of course.
Yeah. So it's like, it's funny. I'll do a little quote later about what the lawyer, the defense lawyer said, but it's pretty funny. And so like I brought before, seeds are very important. And in May, 1992, I believe her name was Denise Johnson, and they found a Palo Verde seed pod in the back of a suspect's truck, and they were able to use that to match it to the crime scene. So I'll go into a little bit more detail about how, but that's where kind of a seed would come in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to touch on some new kind of newish things that people are trying today and what the kind of the advances in forensic botany. So people or researchers are saying that decomposing human bodies can release up to 50 times the amount of nitrogen compared to a dose of nitrogen fertilizer. So there's a lot of nitrogen being released. And they're saying this causes plant leaves to become greener and denser and ramps up the process of making chlorophyll. So this kind of ties into that forensic ecology. Why can I not speak? Ecology. For goodness sakes.
Yep, that's it.
Basic word.
Too much going on.
Seriously, all my mind is like, ah. But, and they're saying that these are, this helps, because they know this now, they're able to identify kind of areas of bodies and because of this nitrogen, and they're trying to use technology that can actually help locate high levels of nitrogen.
Oh,
and
all right.
They're talking about putting those kind, that kind of science and merging it with a, what, I cannot think of, why is my brain dead today? It is a flying machine that people use all the time. You talked about buying
a
one.
A plane?
No, a drone. A drone. Thank you. Attaching, it's right in my notes too. I just couldn't see it.
Yeah.
But they're trying to find like a refractometer attached to a drone that will actually detect these changes. Because a lot of people go missing in places. Like, or let's just say like the forest, like forests, and like hard to reach areas, or especially like missing hikers, you can't reach these areas a lot of the time. And so this kind of helps identify areas that have higher nitrogen levels. They're talking about doing this. I didn't see any people actually being able to yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seems problematic, really. Just like, it's a tree. Oh, wait. No, it's a dead body.
They're able to, I think what they're able to do is like see large increases, like hot spots. Kind of like when you're looking for a missing person. Like you're looking for the body heat. I'm assuming it's something like that where they're. Because otherwise it would just be normal amounts of nitrogen being released.
That's
unless
true.
It's like a really go getter tree. Just like, I'm going to just do this nitrogen so hard. It's on like crack or something.
You never know.
Which could be a dead body underneath and it'd be like, I'm ready. So,
or a deer.
Or a dead deer. That is extremely true. I didn't think about that. Well, they're saying, they say decomposing human bodies. So maybe we're just more nitrogen filled than I did not go too deep. You are making me seem stupid, Taylor. Thank you.
No, I'm just curious. Like it just, I mean, it's not even a thing yet. So I'm just thinking ahead, like, wouldn't that be really easily confused with other nitrogen? You know,
maybe.
I guess it depends. Like in the desert, I feel like, that would totally work.
Yeah.
But like in a you know, rainforest or something, to be like,
right.
Good luck.
Yeah. Well, they say like healthy nitrogen fed plants also reflect more light. So I think it's like, I think it will really be kind of like bright spots that they're able to detect. So.
I do not understand. That is great.
Hey, I just hope, I hope it works. I hope it goes well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't, well, way to think out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
Some other things is, I think I touched on this in a previous episode, but the body farm It is in the University of Tennessee. I really just want to donate my body to the body farm. I want to actually specify for this specifically. So they do a lot of tests on decomposition, obviously. That's primarily what they do. And the researchers actually have this name for a body that is surrounded by plants, and it's called a cadaver decomposition island.
Oh, cadaver, I like that.
Decomposition island.
I love that. That's what I want my body to be.
Yep. And so they do this because there's a process that creates like a necrobiome where the plants grow differently because of the decomposition. And the plants actually can respond quickly to a changing environment. And they've noticed how like exotic invasive species will actually perform differently than other species. So they're kind of like doing tests on that. And so those are the cadaver decomposition islands that they're doing tests on in the University of Tennessee body farm. Which sounds like something I really want to be part of.
Yeah.
Both alive and dead.
I think necrobiome is my word of the day.
Necrobiome. Yeah, it's really cool. So plant ecology also is very useful in the finding graves of missing persons. And it doesn't even matter if the grave is shallow or deep, or if the person was clothed naked or in plastic, because unfortunately people suck and sometimes they put people in plastic.
Wasteful.
But people are able to use plant succession patterns in the area. And a well-trained plant ecologist can actually identify. And this is what I was talking about, people being involved in searching for these sites,
right,
having that background, are able to detect these things. And this plant succession pattern can remain evident for at least a few years, and sometimes even for a decade more.
It reminds me of The Office when Dwight's giving directions to his farm and he's like, if the soil's too acidic, you've gone too far.
Exactly. I love that, man. So much. And so I'll just kind of touch on what like plant succession or ecological succession is. And it's the process or change in the species structure of an ecological community over time. So like an example would be like after a wildfire, it'll look different. So you can kind of tell where a wildfire was, and they'll kind of use that pattern similarly, like with a decomposition body.
Yeah. If something looks a little too advanced.
Yes. You're like, why did
you get
this
secondary?
Like a fairy circle. Something's going on around here.
I always think of that. Like, there's a spot up my street where they sometimes don't mow the grass for very long. And, like, I swear there's a couple, like, fairy rings of mushrooms a few times. And I'm like, that looks like a body shape. Like, are we sure?
I'm going to put a stake in the ground saying, please look at this.
Exhibit A.
Dig me.
If anyone goes missing in this neighborhood.
Just put like all the missing persons photos right there.
Oh.
Oh, man. I really want to do that. Okay. So I'm going to touch on two murder cases. I've already kind of touched on them a bit. I tried to find like famous forensic botany, like that's used in so many cases, and they're very boring. They all just talk about like, oh, we found pollen in the nostril, and it shows that this, it's just like very detailed. So
sure.
It's pretty much just like, it's used in a ton of cases. It was used in the Casey Anthony case. It was used, if anyone's familiar with that case, to like, where her body was found. It's used in the it was actually also used in JonBenet Ramsey case, identifying what she ate previously. I think that's what it's called.
Oh, okay.
So forensic botany also includes people looking at feces and stomach contents and identifying what was eaten, and it's all that helps kind of tell you time of death or what they ate, kind of gives you an idea. I remember one case.
Yeah.
They were trying to figure out when this person died, and they looked in the stomach contents, and they were able to this person, I think, had an omelet or a burger, and the forensic botanist said that there were onions in there. And what was interesting was the cops went to the restaurant the person ate at, and they didn't order anything with onions. So they were like, they're like, oh, it doesn't have onions in the food. And they were like, okay, well, he ate this, but did he eat something after that had onions? So that kind of like did that. But what it turned out to be was they actually watched him make, I believe it was the omelet, and the chef was making onions next to it. And it like it put the onions, that onion residue or biological information mixed together. So,
oh, dang.
Yeah, it was like, dang, that's cool. So even if they didn't order something with onions, it still had onion in it. So
yeah, that's it, very specific.
Cross omelet contamination.
I'm not sure how that helped them, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it mostly just like closed that investigative loop. Because they were like, okay, maybe they ate somewhere else. And they were like, but there's no evidence. No, and so they just went to the restaurant and were like, this is how it got there. But if it wasn't that way, it could have been like, okay, they must have eaten someplace else. Where was that location? And so that's kind of where it's very much more of a location, time benefit.
Right. No, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So the very first case that I talked about in 1935, the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles Lindbergh was the really famous guy who flew a plane.
Not a drone.
Yeah, that guy. I swear, I've listened to so many episodes about this case, and I can never remember. Like, I know he flies a plane, and that's about That's about it. I took a screenshot because I knew I'd forget, and I cannot find it. So,
all right, I know I won't be any help because it was something about a balloon and a baby, and it was never really kidnapped, right?
Nope.
Or is that something else?
Nope. He was very much kidnapped.
Oh. The Lindbergh baby was kidnapped?
Yeah, so I know the actual case. I just can't remember what Charles Lindbergh is famous for, but he was a huge... So he was an American aviator, military man, and he was just like a normal U.S. pilot, but then he became famous and got like the Ortaig Prize for making the first nonstop flight from New York City to Paris. So that's why he became really famous. So what happened was... So his young son was upstairs, and the nurse came to check on the baby, and he was not there, and he was actually kidnapped, and they later found the body of his son pretty close by, I believe, but he was actually kidnapped, and he was actually killed. But what made it kind of sensationalized was because he was really, there was a ton of ransom notes, and they were claiming that he was alive, and they actually were willing to pay, and they were going through all these loops, working with the police, trying to get the baby back until they found the body. And then, like, they even, I think, paid him, I believe.
Oh, wow.
But it's a crazy case because it went on for, like, months. Like, it went on a really long time, kind of stringing along, saying he's alive, we have him, we just need the money, and then we'll get... Because kidnappings are pretty common back. And it was rarely really ended in death, but this one. So, but it did end up ending in death. They suspect that he might have dropped the baby. It may not have been intentional, but they suspect that because of the ladder, they found at the kidnapping site, they found remnants of a ladder and were able to look at the tree rings of the ladder in the wood. Right. And determine like where it came from using that kind of fingerprint analogy for the tree rings. And it looked like it broke, and it wasn't just any old ladder. It was like an invention of a special kind of ladder that that was made, and it looked like it broke and it fell. So they suspect that when the ladder broke, the baby was dropped, and that's why he most likely had to be dumped. So they think it was just an original kidnapping, because this guy was just like huge, super rich, really famous. And they think it started out as a kidnapping and then ended up being a murder.
Gotcha.
But, and so the forensic, they got a dendrochronologist to look at the tree and, or the wood of the ladder. And when they found a suspect, because they, and that kind of goes into a little bit more by dissecting like the ransom letters and figuring out, like narrowing it down to some suspects. They found the guy, they found the blueprints of a very specific ladder in his freaking garage, and they found the wood that was a fingerprint match to the ladder. So they're like, this guy did it. And so the transcript, this is the, from the trial transcript, this is kind of the start of the, of questioning forensic botany and why it's being used. And this is from the defense lawyer from that, questioning the botanist from, in this case. So the defense lawyer says the following: there is no such animal known among men as an expert on wood. That is not a science that has been recognized by the courts. That is not in a class with handwriting experts, with fingerprint experts, or with ballistic experts. The witness probably may testify as an experienced carpenter or something like that, but when it comes to expressing an opinion as an expert or as a scientist, why, that is quite different indeed. We say that the opinion of the jurors is just as good. So this, he's trying to pretty much say, like, anyone can freaking tell trees. Like, this guy's not a scientist, he's practically a carpenter. And, but what I love about this is handwriting and fingerprint experts have both been kind of not dequalified as experts, but it's very much opinion based, and it's very, it's not very scientific. Whereas plant, is, there is no such animal known among men as an expert on wood. Yes, it's called a dendrologist.
Actually,
it's much more scientific than handwriting. Or even fingerprint experts, because that has a lot of human error. But so that was the first case, and that was the first case that it was used. And so that his whole quote was questioning why we're having an expert and why he considers himself an expert. And so this case was pretty much the start of using forensic botany within.
Makes sense.
The next case I'll talk about is about your seed question. So this is how a seed pod was used to solve a crime or help solve a crime. So this was the murder of Denise Johnson, like I mentioned before, in 1992, Arizona. So the forensic botanist, Dr. Tim Helenjaris, he used two Palaverde seed pods and that were found in the suspect's truck, and he was able to compare the genetic material of the seed pods with a tree at the site that looked disturbed. So at the crime scene, they noticed the Palaverde tree looked like it had been hit. And so they're like, okay, this tree is kind of important. And they narrowed it down to suspects and such, and they found two Palo Verde seed pods in the back of the trunk. And so they're like, this was a Palo Verde tree. These are Palo Verde seeds. We're pretty sure they're the same, but we have to prove it in a court of law. So that's where all this freaking money and time comes in. They have to prove that they're from the exact same tree. And so what was pretty amazing about this botanist was he used small sections. So usually to get, like, to match a plant together, you kind of need a whole, a fully mapped DNA, everything. And they don't really have that for plants. So they could
do it now, but
but they didn't for, they didn't have it for this tree yet. So they didn't have it, this tree fully mapped. And so they weren't able to, they didn't have it for the leaves or the seed pods. So what he was able to do was he used small sections of the seed pod's genetic code instead of doing the entire genetic code. And he was able to compare it without having to completely map it. So using those small sections, he, it created a, it's this whole thing called random amplification of polymorphic DNA, or RAPD. And it only took about 3 months, whereas completely mapping the DNA would have taken years. And it showed that the DNA for each tree is actually completely unique. and it was just as precise as, let's say, comparing someone's hair to a human being, like connecting it that
way. Right,
right. And in this case, it showed it as a match, and they were able to success. This was the first scientist, or first time a scientist was able to successfully prove plant paternity genetically, where each, and it showed that each tree is unique and actually have more DNA than
human. Right on.
Mm-hmm. And that guy got arrested and was sentenced to life. I didn't say his name because I don't give a shit about that guy. He sucks.
Just the Palo Verde, the hero.
Just Palo Verde. And then Denise Johnson. May she rest in peace. So I'll kind of go nearing the end of the episode. I'll talk a little bit about what it means to be a forensic botanist and how you kind of can be one. For the most part, it really is a botanist. I looked into this career path because it sounded absolutely wonderful. And pretty much forensic botanists have to have experience examining a wide variety of plant materials and understanding of ecological and environmental significance, such as the study of pollen, trees, tree rings, general plant material, aquatic plants, plant biology, and more. You can obviously specialize in certain things, but most forensic botanists at least have a bachelor's degree in botany, biology, or a subset of botany like plant genetics, plant physiology, evolution, soil science, agriculture, etc. But most actually have a graduate or doctorate degree in their field. And from what I understand and looking into it for myself, is it's mostly you're a botanist and you kind of build up a reputation for yourself and you kind of become a consultant. So you don't you're not really a part of the investigation. You're kind of brought on by a detective to come in. So, and some people have just built up that reputation or just like experience being involved, that that's kind of what they do now. But for the most part, a lot of it is just, you're still just a botanist and you'll do a few consulting a few times.
Okay.
So it's not like it's still a career, but it's mostly botany.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a few people who can really just do this full time, but it's pretty rare, I think. From what I understand, it's mostly you're a botanist who comes in and helps out with cases when.
Gotcha. Yep. No, that's.
And I'm hoping it gets more common and commonly used because it seems to be extremely beneficial, especially just connecting suspects. And because sometimes people don't always leave DNA or fingerprints, especially if it's outdoors. There's not much to leave that kind of information on. And
nothing is permanent.
Nothing is permanent. Exactly. So I'm hoping that this it seems like it's becoming more commonly used, especially in rape cases and such, which is extremely beneficial because people will claim that they've. Like, if you're protected, you don't leave any DNA behind, or if DNA gets washed, you can still connect two people together, which I think is great.
Yeah, definitely.
I think I'm going to end my ranting about a book I really want to read. And I think if you're interested in this topic, I feel like it would be a really great read for you. I'm definitely going to read it. It's called Murder Most Florid by Dr. Mark Spencer. And he just
talked. Murder Most what?
Florid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'll post a picture on Instagram.
Okay.
But it looks like a really cool book, and it follows a forensic botanist who goes through his cases and cases he's worked on and how he's been involved, and pretty much just talks about plants and murder. It's great. So
awesome.
I really want to read it, and I can't recommend it because I haven't read it, but I feel like it would be a good start.
I think you would like it.
Yeah. And it
sounds
seems
interesting.
Yeah, there's a few other books out there, but it seems more like those seem kind of more scientific, whereas this one was more kind of an experience, like going through what this guy went through, and it seemed like really well written and I'm excited to read it. So if you were interested,
yeah,
take a read.
Very nice.
Well, I think that's all I got.
All right. I like it.
Cool.
Learned a lot about, I really didn't have much of an opinion until now, and that answered my questions.
Good. Do you believe in the power of a seed pod now?
I do. I like that a lot.
Good. Isn't it just awesome? It just makes me feel like plants are so powerful.
Yeah, they are. They're in everything.
Yeah.
Like, gotta accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully that it does become a little more commonplace. But yeah, I'm sure just, you know, financially, depending on, you know, where the crimes are taking place, or just, you know, location-wise, if there's not someone who's experienced in that, even just nearby or whatever, it's not going to get used too much. But hopefully that becomes a little bit more commonplace, because that could be just as helpful, if not more helpful, than DNA and whatnot. So
yeah. Yeah, there was definitely like a top five states for forensic botany. California was one of them.
Makes sense.
I think Texas is actually one of them, too. There's actually a Texas Equisearch, which is the search and rescue group. I don't know if that's the one that uses scientists as well as other professionals, but there's a bunch of like search and rescue groups, nonprofit groups that like to use people with a background to help find missing persons, or they'll like search areas where it's suspected that bodies might be.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think Texas Equisearch was involved during the Casey Anthony case, actually. I think they helped search.
Nice.
And they eventually sued.
Oh, wow.
Because they think she did it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Or, sorry, Kaylee Anthony is the daughter. And so Casey Anthony is the mom. So it's always called the Casey Anthony case. But Texas Equisearch was involved. And after the trial, I think they tried to sue her for the cost of the search, because she wasn't honest about, like, she was just lying the entire time.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so.
I'm assuming she was dead, but Kaylee.
Oh, Anthony, yeah, she was, she passed, she was, like, a few blocks away from Casey Anthony's house.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so it's, this kind of goes into the whole case, but Casey Anthony claimed that she was kidnapped by Zanny the nanny, and they found no evidence of that person ever existing after being lied to multiple times about her having a job. Like, she literally took them to Disneyland saying that she worked there. She walked them to like literally through Disneyland. She's like, at the end, they're like, oh, you can take us to your office. She's like, okay, I don't actually work here. And they're like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, literally, she was just lying to the cops the whole time. And it was after that she was like, yeah, this Zanny. Like, she came up with this whole story about, like, all of her coworkers, and none of them, either they didn't exist or they didn't have kids. So she claimed they had kids. Like, really weird, like, crazy, intensive lies. So, but she was acquitted, and she was not, she was found not guilty for at least the charge of murder.
All right.
But after that, she was
obstruction of justice.
She was charged with lying to the cops, I think, a few charges of that.
Okay.
Anyways, yeah, Texas Equisearch was involved in that.
Gotcha. Well, very good. Are we ready to end with a little pun off here?
I am trying. Considering how hard it's been to pronounce words, I don't have high hopes for this.
maybe I'll actually contribute this week. We'll see. So far, not so much. All right. I am generating randomly. How about truffle? And go.
Every day I'm truffling. So I'm going to truffle on over to you whenever you're ready.
I will truffle through the sentence.
life is such a truffle.
Yeah, I'm in a lot of truffle after these last puns.
That was a good one.
Thanks.
The truffle is real, man.
Yep.
uh, Ruffle. Oh man, what else? Truffle. Truffle of wisdom after listening to this episode.
I agree. I was going to say, good thing this isn't a Dr. Seuss book. The truffle of trees.
Oh, the truffle Sorry. Of trees. That would have worked. That was good.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plantaholics.
Hope you can join us next week for more plant talk.
In the meantime, you can check us out on Instagram and Facebook or visit our website at plantaholicspodcast.com.
Thanks, everyone.
See you next time.